One is now in session.
Thanks, everyone. Please be seated. Oh, there is some dim lighting out there.
Justice is blind.
Oh, yeah. Good morning, everyone. We are here for oral argument beginning with Harstead v. Chandler, RCV 240824. As you know, we record and live stream these proceedings, so please give your name and the name of the party you're representing before you begin. You each have a maximum of 20 minutes per side. You're not required to use all the time, but appellant, we do require that you keep track of your own time. There are clocks on the podium. Please keep in mind that before the argument this morning, we have read all the briefings, studied the record, and discussed the case in conference this morning. And with that, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is David Abney. I'm here representing the plaintiff appellant. I have an unusual honor today. My clients usually stay away from my oral arguments. I think they don't want to see the train wreck, but I'm here today with Cassidy and Jordan Harstadt, the parents, the parents of the deceased, Andrew Harstadt. I also feel like I'm in the Twilight Room, you know, the boom lounge.
We're having lighting issues, but
okay, well, it's very
embrace the mood.
Very relaxing, yes. I hope that by now we've moved past the point where we view suicide as some sort of immoral, illegal act, and it cuts off all kind of liability. Courts have been moving steadily in the direction of recognizing that suicide can indeed be foreseeable, and that it is preventable, and that it is not correct to blame the victim of the suicide for what happened. So often, the people who make this choice, to the extent it is a choice, don't really have control over what they're doing. We're not saying the school district is the sole cause of the suicide. Certainly there's many other factors that would have come into play. But the theory of liability in Arizona under comparative fault is if you contribute even slightly to causing the result, you can be held liable by a jury assessing fault at the conclusion of the case. And here there were a number of times, unlike Dinsmore, where the school district had control over Andrew, and over the students who were bullying him on campus. They had control on campus. There were a number of incidents. Plus, the school district knew about incidents off campus that should have contributed to their willingness and ability and desire to take some sort of protective measures. I mean, going through the record as closely and as well as I can't find anything indicating the school district did much of anything at all to protect this young man. The school district knew the kids who were involved in this bullying. Incidents occurred on campus, but there's no indication that they were expelled, that they were disciplined, that they were forced to stop the bullying. And the cumulative effect, well, the cumulative effect we submit is that it contributed to causing the suicide. You go back, the very first notice I think the school district had was back in August of 2021. There was an off-campus kidnapped attempt, and the school district was informed about that. And then on the 20th, Andrew was forced out of a marketing class and into a bathroom. There was going to be another, which is really a kidnapping, and he was going to be beaten down until a student fortunately came in and said, "What's going on here?" And these cowards left before they completed their efforts. There was another off-campus assault on the 21st of August in 2021. There was an assault and an altercation on the football field on school property going into August November 12, 2021. There was notice to the school that an injunction had been taken out against one of the bullies. And the school just seems to be out of contact with what's going on here. Just you go through the record, just you end up shaking your head. What are they doing? What are they thinking of? You get this odd testimony from the high school counselor that I didn't realize bullying was going on. That's way down in February of 2022.
Are there specific acts that you contend the school should have undertaken after receiving notice of the injunction?
What should have been done?
Are there specific steps of concretely that you contend should have been undertaken that weren't?
Well, I think there are a number of steps that could have been taken. I don't know if we're there yet, mm-hmm. but to the extent that you want me to address that, sure.
I didn't know if the pleadings might have framed it or some part of the record that would have escaped our notice to this point. Just your thoughts.
Well, the school policies say that they can discipline people who are causing bullying mm-hmm. on campus, and that was occurring, but there's no discipline in the record that ever happened. That may have stopped it. That may have made the environment on campus much easier for Andrew to deal with. But nothing was done. Over and over, nothing was done. And I understand the politics of all of this, politics in the sense of schools don't want to upset the parents of bullies. You know, they're still parents, and but you've got to take a stand. At some point, you've got to say, enough's enough. And we're going to do something concrete to help people who are in this sort of situation.
Is the injunction one that had a spatial exclusion to it? Like, was the injunction against harassing Andrew one that had like a spatial exclusion? People were not to approach him or something like that?
I think I missed that. Can you repeat that?
I thought you said the school was on notice of an injunction.
Yes.
I'm asking you about the characteristics of the injunction. Please describe it.
Yes. And there were things like, well, he happened to have the same lunch period, and there was a big hoo-ha mm-hmm. about getting lunch period. Somebody moved on the lunch period mm-hmm. In the same classes, and they're just not making sure that Andrew is protected.
Right.
That is really for the jury to decide when you get right down to it, what could have been done, what should have been done.
Mm-hmm. Counselor, how is this different from Dinsmore?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, my heart goes out to the family for what happened, but this, this is largely off campus.
Yes. Well, the difference in Dinsmore is burned in my mind because that was one of my notable crash and burns, but there was really nothing I could do about it based on the facts. The facts in Dinsmore was the school district knew there were some problems, but they didn't have custody and control over the actors in what finally happened in the final events. And here, there is custody and control over a period of time, over the actors who were involved, over Andrew, over his tormentors, but nothing is done.
But in Dinsmore, there were students at the school, so didn't the school have the same kind of subversion and control there as they did here?
Well, there were incidents at school, but there was no indication I ever saw that they understood that there would be murder in the offing or there would be suicide in the offing. And the young woman was convinced that she could go and meet her former boyfriend off campus with no harm, and the school didn't have any indication that there was going to be something bad happen. And I remember I went through that record on that pretty hard and did the best I could to say, well, I should have known, could have done this, that, and the other. And in the end, I had to admit that the Supreme Court got it right. There just was not that geographical time connection. But here we've got the bullying students under control. We've got Andrew under control. We've got things that can be done on school to alleviate the problem, which wasn't the case, unfortunately, in Dinsmore. I remember I was so steamed, I wrote a motion for reconsideration to the Supreme Court, which is just lunacy. And Justice Timmer swatted that down in a nice multi-page thing. You've got to be kidding. And I think she was right. I was just so angry about the case and losing. But Dinsmore is not precedent for this case. It's precedent showing that this case is different.
Is your argument, though, really something that you have to make to the Supreme Court and we're kind of a stopping place in the sense that, you know, you're arguing that Coward and DeMontenay, if that's how you say it correctly, are mere dicta, but they are statements by our Supreme Court that we can't ignore. So I wonder if it's just that your real argument is upstairs and saying and getting them to comment about the state of the language that tells us that otherwise this may not be a winning argument, and that you need to confirm with them. Was that dicta? Is that something you want to change? Should we look at, as you suggested at the beginning of your oral argument, should the concept of suicide and the old kind of social way we looked at it be changed and reflected in the law?
The basic answer to the question, the way you framed it, is no. I hate having to go to the Supreme Court. Occasionally you win, but it's just the last desperate gasp. But no, I don't think that the Supreme Court has ever specifically adopted the suicide rule. And I tried to convince this court of that in part and failed. But I still believe it's a valid argument. And you have cases like DeMontini, which said, well, yes, there can be liability for failure to properly take care for a person when they're under control in a custodial situation. Then more recently, we have the Hager case, the district court case, interpreting Arizona law. And I know it's just a federal district court, but I think the court got it right. It was a patient in a VA outpatient clinic, and they didn't have custody and control over that patient by any means. But the court said, well, it can be reasonably foreseeable that things you do and don't do may contribute to causing a suicide. And that's what the situation is here. It's going to be up to a jury to go through these facts and say, yes, we think the school district could have done better. They could have done certain things. And they would get into the standard of care. That's their job. And therefore, we're going to find that there's liability. I don't think there's any question about duty here. There is a special relationship between a school and its students. There was custody and control at critical points over the actors involved in this. There was an ability to change things. And, of course, there was a duty to change things. I delved a bit into the workers' compensation cases, and I know the usual refrain I get is, it's a workers' compensation case. Well, yes, it is. But it's important. The judges are trying to figure out, and justices are trying to figure out, well, is there going to be coverage? Because is this an intervening superseding cause? And in the workers' compensation context, they don't have any problem with saying, yes, this can be an intervening cause, but it's not a superseding one. Just because if you get so banged up or stressed out or upset or whatever the right word is because of what happened in an industrial injury, that you think suicide is the only way out or that you lose all control and suicide is the result, then there's going to be compensation in the workers' compensation. Why there should be a difference between workers' compensation and a tort case in this particular aspect, I don't know. I don't understand it. And I don't think there should be a difference, quite frankly. There was this amazing case that I stumbled across late at night, which I usually stumble across things, Tuminello from the Sixth Circuit, where the court said, if a school is aware of a student being bullied but does nothing to prevent the bullying, it is reasonably foreseeable that the victim of the bullying might resort to self-harm, even suicide. That seems like a sensible rule, and one that Arizona courts would be wise, I believe, to follow. I noticed, unless I missed it, I do not think that my colleague across the aisle addressed Tuminello at all in the answering brief. And it's in the opening brief and in the reply brief as reliable authority that the court can rely on. I know it's not an Arizona case, but it is one of the most respected courts of appeal in the nation. Unless there's further questions, I'll reserve my time.
Anything further?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Chris Welker, and I represent the appellee defendant, Chandler Unified School District. Our briefs extensively discuss the Cowart and DeMontigny cases, Supreme Court cases where our Supreme Court established what it called the almost universal rule, is how they referred to it in Cowart. In the DeMontigny case, they referred to it as the general rule, that a voluntary suicide is an intervening superseding cause that relieves the original actor of any liability. This has been the established rule in Arizona now for over half a century. This court, of course, both parties cited in our briefs, this court's decision in Parton v. Jeans in 2019 involving a legal malpractice action over a failure to timely file a wrongful death action arising from a suicide. And this court in that case confirmed the general rule, the majority rule, confirmed that the Supreme Court's precedent required this court to find there was no cause of action in that case, Parton v. Jeans, for a voluntary suicide. And I believe this case, this court has addressed that issue again in another unpublished opinion. And plaintiff is advocating for a change in Arizona law. And as this court correctly pointed out in the Parton case, that change would have to come either from the Supreme Court or the legislature. And to the question about whether it's dicta or critical to the holding, I would like to point to the DeMontenay case, which was, of course, 15 years after the Cowart case. In DeMontenay, the Supreme Court stated that in Cowart, the court considered the following issue. What is the liability for suicide occurring in a juvenile detention home? And then in DeMontenay, the Supreme Court said, in resolving this issue, we noted that under the general rule, suicide by the injured party is a superseding cause, which is neither foreseeable nor a normal incident of the risk created, and therefore relieves the original actor from liability. So in DeMontenay, the Supreme Court itself specifically said that the general rule was part of the holding in Cowart. It said that in resolving the issue in Cowart, the Supreme Court declared the general rule. Now, of course, in Cowart and DeMontenay, the court goes on to analyze whether the exception to the general rule applied, the so-called institutional case, where a mental institution has custody and control of the patient that commits suicide. But there would be no need for the Supreme Court to discuss the exception, the institutional case exception, without the general rule. So, of course, the general rule is critical to the holding, but more importantly, it is the stated rule by the Supreme Court, even if it were dicta. Of course, it's dicta from the Supreme Court. It's the Supreme Court's declared rule. And this court, as it pointed out in Parton, is required to follow it. Now, I'm grateful that counsel brought up the Dinsmore case. In Dinsmore, in 2021, our Supreme Court unequivocally stated that the scope of the student-school relationship is limited by geography and time. In fact, the Supreme Court stated that the scope of the duty arises when the student is either at school or otherwise in the school's control. So the key elements of the duty analysis in Dinsmore were the school's custody and control of the student. So counsel said that the duty is not at issue here and is not in dispute. It is very much in dispute. The trial court, in its order granting summary judgment, specifically cited the Monroe v. Basis case, which the Dinsmore court approved of explicitly, and stated that there was no duty in this case. That is in the trial court's order here. And there is no duty in this case as well. Even if there wasn't the suicide rule, which governs the case, and it does, but in Dinsmore, it was clear that the duty only extends while the student is at school or otherwise under the control of the school. Here, there's no dispute that this sad tragedy occurred in the decedent's home while he was under his parents' custody and control. In fact, in Dinsmore, the court stated, once the student is released from school and returned to his parents' custody and control, the special relationship ends. And so there was no special relationship under Dinsmore at the time of the suicide.
Well, it's kind of interesting, counsel, and this is kind of far afield, but this is an area of the law where, as your opposing counsel acknowledges, the law seems to be fairly settled. There have been U.S. Supreme Court cases talking about, you know, expressive rights, and when we think about the expressive rights of children, we consider the school to have effects on the children outside of the time when they are reposed in school. Like there was that Maine case about free expression, and there was a Facebook case a couple of years ago. I'm not asking you to remember those. I obviously don't have them close in mind, but it's not so clear that when children are not in school that there's no possibility of a negative legal interaction between the children's family and the school, right? I mean, that seems a bit overstated to me.
Well, Dinsmore did recognize, thank you, Your Honor, Dinsmore did recognize that there can be unique circumstances. That was the mm-hmm. phrase mm-hmm. the Supreme Court used. There can be unique circumstances where the risks of harm arise while the student is under the custody and control of the school, though the harm occurs off campus. Mm-hmm. First, the court said those were unique circumstances. But also, the key inquiry was that the risk of harm still had to occur while the student was under the custody and control of the school. Here, there is absolutely nothing in the record that the school was ever aware of any suicidal ideation in this young man. And importantly, it's undisputed, the student had only attended school the semester of his death, for 2 weeks total. The suicide occurred in May of 2022, and the record is undisputed that he had only attended school for 2 weeks total during that entire semester and had not been at school for several weeks. In fact, the student had been hospitalized in a mental health facility from March 28th to March 30th, just 6 weeks before his suicide. He was taken to the mental health facility by his father, and there he was admitted to the hospital because of suicidal ideation related to several issues, but unrelated to school. Nothing was mentioned about school when he was admitted to the hospital. So in this case, the decedent had not been in school for several weeks, had only attended 2 weeks of the entire semester, had been hospitalized 6 weeks before his death, and had been returned to his parents' custody and control. And so there was nothing to suggest that the school still exercised custody or control when the risk of the suicide occurred.
So I have a question that's sort of more an observation, and I very much take your points about the specific facts here. They're very well taken and well made. But as to the general analysis of duty that was the starting point of your discussion about 2 minutes ago, it seems a little facile in the law in general, not putting this on you, it's how we construct things as lawyers and judges, right, to say with something like human depression, well, you know, I have a duty. When you're here, it's from 7:30 to 3:30, I have a duty, and people are being mean to you, and people are saying awful things to you and making you fear for yourself, you know, at school, and I have a duty. And the minute they go home, they carry those things with them. The internal state of depression doesn't switch off when those stimuli switch off when the last school bell sounds, right?
I agree, Your Honor.
So I mean, I'm just saying, doesn't it seem like this analysis of duty is a little, not yours, but the laws, is a little facile and a little artificial to say that these internal subjective states that come to us during the day, because the school is our custodian, it's our walls, and then we go home and we have to carry that with us, right? I mean, why would duty switch on and off like a light switch that way?
I believe what the Supreme Court focused on in Dinsmore was the ability of the school to act, to control the student. Mm-hmm. And in this case, again, there were several weeks that passed from the time he had last attended school. He had been hospitalized. He had been returned to his parents' care. The school had no notice whatsoever of any suicidal ideation and had no ability to act. And in this case, this kind of gets to the facts, and it does get to our other argument, which is that there, even without the suicide rule, there was no evidence of causation beyond sheer speculation. Because here, he was hospitalized, treated by a psychiatric expert. His parents had much more knowledge about his state, his condition, his suicidal ideation than the school. The school never learned anything about suicidal ideation.
What about the injunction specifically? I was kind of intrigued by that, the school having notice of the injunction. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I looked at the injunction while Your Honor was asking those questions, and it does not preclude the subject of the injunction from attending school. It precludes him from going to the decedent's home or workplace, but it did not preclude him from going to school.
But it puts the school on notice that there's someone who is a tormentor or harasser or someone who the law sees fit to exclude from dealing with Andrew, right?
Correct. And the school did receive the injunction and took steps, changed schedules, mm-hmm. changed lunch hours, did some things to separate the kids. Now, one important point that needs to be made: counsel has referred to today and repeatedly in the briefs that he doesn't find evidence of discipline or expulsion of the other students. Well, there's a federal privacy law, FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, that precludes schools from disclosing to third parties the student disciplinary records of a student. So those records could not be revealed. They couldn't share a student's private disciplinary records with others. And so... The school's put in a position where we're told, well, I don't find anything about the discipline of these other students. In fact, there is an email in the record. It's an exhibit to plaintiff's statement of facts below, which I believe is in the index of record at 17, there's an email where the school principal or assistant principal states, I'm not able to share with you all of the disciplinary action we've taken against these other students because of federal privacy laws. So that's not something that the school was free to talk about. And so we're in this conundrum where plaintiff says that, well, I don't see anything that was done here. Well, we couldn't talk about what was done because of federal privacy laws. But to the broader point about what could be done, again, the psychiatric hospital, the parents, who had much more information about this young man's mental state, were unable to prevent this. And yet the school, who knew nothing about the mental state and his suicidal ideation, is alleged to have failed to act to prevent it when the psychiatric professionals did not.
Do you have experience with getting these injunctions where you have two students going to the same school? Is it unusual that there isn't a kind of distance, a proximity requirement to the injunction because they are both going to school? I mean, is that the usual way that it happens when you see them, where a minor has an injunction against another minor through their parents, but where there are proximity restrictions on one of the students' movements?
So, Your Honor, it varies. The injunctions take all shapes and forms. In this one, there was no proximity limitation. It didn't say the subject of the injunction must stay so many feet away. It did say that the defendant in the injunctive relief should not contact the decedent, should not harass or threaten or assault him. But there wasn't a proximity restriction. It didn't preclude him from going to school, so now the district has to allow him to school. And then, as I said, the district does what it can to separate the schedules, change the lunch hours. But
is
this,
in the record any kind of protocol that your district has when an injunction against harassment is brought to the school's attention? Was that in the record at all about what the protocol would be, or are there policies around that?
No, I don't believe there's anything in the record about how to respond to an injunction.
Okay.
But in this case, too, it's important to note, so the injunction was issued in November of 21, 6 months before the suicide. Most of the acts that the council refers to of bullying or harassment occurred either off campus, outside of the school's control, or many, many months before the suicide. The last issue of bullying or harassment, and the main one, occurred in February of 2022, roughly 3 months before the suicide, but again, was entirely off campus. It was at the decedent's home, a horrible incident where purported friends circulated nude photos of the decedent through social media. Again, that was entirely outside of the school's custody and control. That happened while he was at home with friends. And from the record, it does not appear that the decedent returned to school hardly at all, if at all, after that incident in February. So again, there are nearly 3 months of no attendance at school, while, sadly, the decedent is battling substance abuse, depression, and all kinds of other issues completely unrelated to the school. And there was no ability for the school to do anything to control the student. There's no evidence from which we could determine that the school could have done anything, which I would submit is the policy behind the suicide rule. Again, well established by the Supreme Court, its precedent, it's been followed by this court before. But the policy makes sense because the person with the most knowledge about why the suicide occurred is no longer with us, cannot testify, cannot be cross-examined, and that is the person who knows the most. And so in this case, we have suicide notes, of course, that are in the record, several pages of them. The decedent wrote that he had made the notes within the month of leading up to a suicide, and the notes refer to all kinds of issues that he was battling. It doesn't make any reference to school whatsoever, not one reference in any of the suicide notes to school. They talk about his battles with depression, with anxiety, with substance abuse, a breakup with his girlfriend, and all kinds of things that he attributes to his mental state. Again, not one reference to school. And importantly, the suicide notes also reference the fact that he had attempted suicide over a year earlier, which was before he had even started attending this high school and before any of the events that council discussed occurred. So he remarks in that, in his suicide notes, sadly and tragically, and our hearts do bleed for this situation, but he remarks that he wished that his attempt a year earlier had been successful. And then he talks about all of the challenges that he was going through. None of them involved the school. None of them referenced the school. And that is why we have this general rule, or almost universal rule, as the Supreme Court calls it, as this court acknowledged in the Parton v. Jeans case, that it must follow, that suicide is always a superseding event that relieves the original actor of liability. And there are strong policy reasons behind that. But in this case, we would also suggest and submit that there is no evidence beyond sheer speculation that there was anything that the school could have done or that any of its alleged omissions was a substantial factor in bringing about this tragedy. And that's the test, of course, for proximate causation. It must be a substantial factor. But more importantly, the suicide rule is well established. It's established by the Supreme Court, and it's precedent that this court has followed and must follow. Unless there are any other questions, that's all I have.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If there's one thing we learn as lawyers, it's rules are made to be distinguished and applied appropriately. You asked a question earlier, Judge Jacobs, about depression switching off. You get to these situations, mental states don't arise at the snap of a finger. I suppose there could be some sort of traumatic event. I mean, the survivors of the Twin Towers, for instance, they were changed unalterably in a matter of minutes and will never be the same. But this is different. This is a question of time. The stress, despair, hopelessness builds up, and you have your school that's supposed to be protecting you and doesn't. Over and over, it doesn't. We talked earlier about the episodes in August and November, and then you get into February of the next year, 2022, and April, where there's bullying at school over compromising photos. They're trying to get help so that Andrew can participate in the one big thing in his life, which is football. He's a very good football player. And he wanted to be on the team, and they wouldn't even make accommodations for him there so he could dress out separately and not have harassing, bullying comments made based upon the photos that circulated. The school failed this young man over and over. They had an opportunity to take care of business and to make sure that he was protected. Now, they talk about privacy, so we can't find out, but we do get some interesting circumstantial evidence because the same names of these same harassing students keep popping up, and they're still doing the same stuff at the school that they were doing before. So if the school is doing something, it's not doing anything that's effective.
Counsel, again, I'm sympathetic to the situation. But when you talk about distinguishing, I don't see how this is distinguishable from Dinsmore, because you've got students who are under the control of the school for the time that they're in school. But once they're out of school, out of the custody of the school, a school is no longer has a duty to them. So I'm having a hard time distinguishing this case from Dinsmore.
Well, it's what we're saying the school should have done. That wasn't the same as in Dinsmore. In Dinsmore, it was protecting this woman, the young woman, from going out this one particular day to meet this one particular student off campus.
Well, but I've studied that case. I've had arguments regarding Dinsmore. As I understand the argument in Dinsmore, is that the school knew that the student was in danger and should have warned her or done more to restrain
Yeah, that was my theory, and it went to the end of the dock and fell off.
Yeah.
The court wouldn't accept it. But here the theory is the school district has contributed to causing the deterioration of the student's mental health, his emotional health, by not doing anything to protect him, not doing anything to foster his sense of belonging and well-being at the school, not taking care of these problems as they arose. This, the duty on here is, well, the standard of care is to do something effective to make sure that the bullying stops, or and that the student has some sort of resource to deal with the after effects and the consequences of the bullying. That's completely different from Dinsmore. Dinsmore, my theory was that the district knew or should have known, based upon all the evidence, that there was something bad was going to happen if they let this woman go. All they had to do was to hold that student until her mom could show up and take her away, and this event would not have happened. And the court said, no, we look at the facts, too, Mr. Abney, and under our analysis of the facts, the school simply did not have enough information to know that there was a real risk when they let her go. And that's a difference here. Here, the school district is doing things and not doing things that are contributing to this growing sense of isolation, of helplessness and hopelessness. I mean, he can't even get the school to help him out. And this over and over again, he's being harassed and bullied, and the school's not doing anything about it. Now, how much that contributed, you know, you probably have to do something equivalent of a psychological autopsy to find out for sure and get some definitive information from the jury, but we're not at that point. And we can't get to that point until we get past the notion that the suicide is unforeseeable and that the school district did nothing at all to contribute to causing this situation. It did do a lot to contribute to causing this situation. It's different from Dinsmore, I submit to Your Honor. As far as the evidence of disciplinary records, as I said before, there's circumstantial evidence on that point. And I don't know, a determined lawyer ought to be able to get these things under seal and find out what was done and was not done. And there's got to be a way to circumvent that. I don't know for sure because I wasn't the trial lawyer, but I bet dollars to donuts there's some way to get around that. I don't know. I think I've hit all the major points. If there's any other questions, I hope that the court will look on this with some favor. I'm not asking to get rid of the suicide rule, although I think that would be a marvelous thing, but that's going to be for the Supreme Court. But this is a distinguishable kind of situation. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. And thank you both for your argument. We'll take this matter under advisement and issue our decision in due course. We'll stand in recess to reset for the next argument, but we will stay on the bench while that's happening. Thank you.